Hello, I'm Richard Walker. Welcome to Network Europe. Coming up on the programme, we look ahead to the much-anticipated 50th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome. Berlin's throwing a party, and we're all invited. The French media is taking flak for its coverage of the country's presidential campaign.
We're reaching a point where the journalist, who is always following the trail of a candidate, is not competent enough to ask questions about his or her programme. It's completely absurd.
Communism's gone, but now capitalism's threatening Bucharest's architectural heritage. And in other business, Holland's largest bank throws a curveball at its staff by employing a fake inspirational guru. We meet the fake guru himself. All that and more coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters. But first, as dates in the Brussels calendar go, it's bigger than Christmas. The piece of paper that got Europe started, the Treaty of Rome, is about to turn 50. Germany currently holds the rotating presidency of the EU, and so Berlin's hosting a big birthday bash. And we'll see the signing of a grand new piece of paper called the Berlin Declaration. But let's start with the celebrations. Stephen Castle is Network Europe's Brussels correspondent and joins me now. Stephen, German Chancellor Angela Merkel wants to mark this date properly, doesn't she?
In Berlin, there is going to be something of a party. In fact, the German presidency of the European Union, which is hosting the event, is planning a special event, a night of nightclubbing. So you'll be able to buy a ticket to enter most of the city's nightclubs. So there's going to be a night of partying, and they're spending something like 1.5 million euros on the whole event, which should be quite a big media opportunity for the German presidency and indeed for the European Union. It's not often that the EU gets the chance to present itself in this in a positive way on the international stage, and this is one opportunity for it.
Do you get the feeling that people, that your average European is buying into this celebration? Are they getting enthusiastic about it?
Well, I think it's a little early to say that. I suspect most people aren't as yet fully aware of the anniversary. It's the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Rome, which most people won't really be aware of. However, I think in Berlin itself, there will probably be a certain amount of excitement because the Germans proved highly successful last year in staging a World Cup, which caught the imagination of the public. And I think what the authorities in Berlin will be seeking to do is to replicate that, albeit on a slightly lower scale. It's significant, in fact, as we're talking about football, that already there's been a football match to celebrate the 50th anniversary. It was a Europe 11 against Manchester United. And that shows that the EU is trying to reach out to people and use forms of popular culture to do so.
So that's the social side of this anniversary that's being marked. But there is a political element to it as well, and something called the Berlin Declaration. What's that?
That's right. Well, it wouldn't be a European event if the politicians of the continent were not intent on making a grand declaration. And indeed, that's what they're going to do. They're going to all meet. The heads of government are all going to meet in Berlin, and they're going to issue a declaration which will mark this 50th anniversary. And of course, it wouldn't be a European event if there wasn't quite a lot of disagreement about what should go into this declaration. There seem to be at least three elements, one looking at the history of the European Union, another looking at the values of the European Union, and a third looking at the future of the European Union. That much is clear. But in fact, this process of drafting the Berlin Declaration has emerged as quite a controversial one because it's been done very much behind closed doors. Chancellor Angela Merkel is determined that this shouldn't be a committee effort because those documents that are put together after lengthy EU negotiations tend to be, firstly, very long and, secondly, completely unreadable.
Network Europe, Stephen Castle in Brussels there. Now, no offence, Stephen, but reporting on the popping of champagne corks in Berlin is a pretty cushy assignment compared to the work facing our French counterparts at the moment. On the face of it, French journalists should be delighted. With only 5 weeks to go before the first round, the French presidential campaign is still wide open. The main candidates have a lot of personality, and one of them's even photogenic. But actually, the hacks are a bit depressed. Almost 60% of French people say they're not satisfied with the media's coverage of the campaign. And to make things worse, there are now TV shows with no journalists on them at all, where citizens question the candidates directly. Radio France International's Nick Champeau is still happy, but thought he should find out more about why some of his fellow professionals aren't.
Nicolas Demorand.
Bonjour, madame. Et bienvenue
Bonjour.
Sur France Inter. François Bayrou, président de l'UDF, toujours porté par la vague des sondages.
The task of journalists is a difficult one. First, they need to come up with good questions. Then they must try to force politicians to answer them.
Vous proposez quoi de changer?
Ah, moi, je propose rien, je pose des questions.
Supprimer l'élection présidentielle? Mais vous êtes vraiment rigolo, vous.
This is increasingly difficult because the well-media-trained candidates have become masters at the art of beating around the bush. Nicolas Demorand knows. He hosts France Inter's flagship morning program every day.
I had Nicolas Sarkozy in the radio show on Monday morning, and I asked him why he wanted to create a department for immigration and national identity. Do we need a department for national identity? I asked the question, I think, four times.
Français. Oui, mais surtout, est-elle du ressort d'un ministère, Nicolas
Attends,
Sarkozy?
Mais, monsieur Morand, je vais pas fuir, hein. Rassurez-vous, mais je veux bien expliquer parce que c'est tellement sérieux, c'est tellement important.
And he was saying, I'm going to answer the question. Just wait a moment. I just want to say something. Yes, don't forget to answer the question. Yeah, I'm coming to the answer. And it was finished and he didn't answer the question.
Politicians might get away with it because few journalists force them to answer questions. The task for a determined journalist is similar to walking a tight rope because listeners do not like journalists who interrupt politicians. Véronique Maurice is ombudswoman with the national daily paper Le Monde.
The public doesn't appreciate at all because then the journalist seems aggressive. And it turns in favor of the candidate who appears as a pure victim.
La semaine de Ségolène Royal, notre candidate, est marquée par toute une série d'interventions télévisées ou radiodiffusées.
Ségolène Royal's special advisor Jacques Lang telling journalists about his candidate's radio and TV appearances of the week. Candidates need the media. And the media needs candidates. Journalists need to be fed information. They need to be kept busy. So there's something planned every day. An off-the-record lunch with a candidate, a trip, a political conference, a workshop, or a press briefing. During the Jacques Lang briefing I attended, journalists didn't ask a single question about Royal's proposals for the country. All the questions had to do with campaign strategy, maneuvers, and catty remarks. Daniel Schneiderman says that's one of the reasons why French people are disappointed. Schneiderman hosts the weekly program Arrêt sur Image, which analyzes journalistic work on France 5 television.
On n'est pas très éclairé sur les enjeux de l'élection.
We're not well informed about the stakes of the election. We know a lot about the competition, the assets of Ségolène, François and Nicolas. We know about the books that they like and the cakes that they like. We're bombarded with opinion polls. But apart from that, we don't learn much. The media prefers to talk about political games and maneuvers rather than about the stakes of the campaign.
Plutôt de parler des enjeux de la campagne.
The other problem, Schneiderman says, is that journalists who follow the same candidate all the time only know that candidate and not much else.
We've asked the embedded journalists about whether they sometimes discuss content with the candidates that they're following. We asked, do you talk about industrial policies, unemployment? And they always answer, oh no, we're not experts on that. We're reaching a point where the journalist who is always following the trail of a candidate is not competent enough to ask questions about his or her program. It's completely absurd.
Puisque lui-même n'est pas spécialiste. C'est énorme.
There is a paradox, Véronique Maurice says. French people complain that the real issues are not covered, but readers of Le Monde particularly enjoy more trivial articles about the candidates' personalities and catty remarks. Véronique Maurice.
We are publishing whole pages, which are called Focus, and it's a whole page that explains the problem and then all the programs and the proposals of the candidates. And we have no letters on that. I mean, which seems tends to show that few people read them really. They ask for deep analysis, and they run for short stories. that's the fact.
The French public is increasingly demanding and defiant. Thanks to the internet and video sites such as YouTube, they can directly access information themselves. France Inter's Nicolas Demorand.
I read hundreds of emails, and they say, why didn't you talk about, I don't know, this video I saw on YouTube that shows that Ségolène Royal, etc., etc., that shows that Nicolas Sarkozy said this, etc., etc., that shows that François Bayrou.
So in a nutshell, you're saying that the same way that there are 60 million French football coaches during the World Cup, there are 60 million journalists during the campaign.
Yeah, 60 million editors. I don't know if there are 60 million journalists, but people who's got an opinion, an advice on the things. Yes, now with internet, they say, I think that, and I didn't hear my point of view in your interview. So give us information, and afterwards we're going to say what we think about it. And I think that's quite new.
Nick Champeau, Paris, RFI.
Now, from Paris, we go to a city that, between the two world wars, was dubbed Little Paris with its French-inspired architecture. But for the Romanian capital, Bucharest, the communist era meant entire neighbourhoods being demolished to make room for blocks of flats. The communist era is over, but it seems that what's left of Bucharest's architectural legacy is now threatened by runaway capitalism. Radio Romania's Iulian Murusan lives in a city that's changing fast.
Now I'm standing in front of what is now 15th story building and still going up. And right next to it, there is the St. Joseph Catholic Cathedral. I see a panel here saying that this working site has noise protection. But it doesn't sound like it.
Every day on my way to the radio, I walk past this most controversial construction site in Bucharest, an office tower which is being built within no more than 8 meters from the side wall of St. Joseph's Roman Catholic Cathedral in downtown Bucharest. You can guess that the Roman Catholic Archbishopric in Bucharest is not delighted with the idea. Besides the visual and phonic discomfort it causes, this office building is erected illegally and is a hazard to the safety of St. Joseph's Cathedral. Emmanuel Nekula is a structure engineer living in New York, but he worked on the Cathedral Plaza project, as the office building is called.
In my contractual agreement, I have asked the local representative or developer to perform a series of scientific research is regarding the seismic component of the site, the wind analysis of the structure, the snow accumulations to the surrounding properties and everything. That was never done. Since the cathedral was never reinforced for a seismic event, with such a tower nearby, the cathedral itself will have no chance to survive.
Meaning that it can
it will collapse at the first major earthquake.
Work has never stopped at the Cathedral Plaza, though the Roman Catholic Archbishopric sued the beneficiary. But the file is dragging endlessly, being moved from one court to another. Not even a recommendation by a committee of the Romanian Senate to stop the works has been heeded. Civil society is protesting against what it calls the destruction of the city by reckless real estate development. The only open square of Bucharest is Revolution Square, where the Romanians gathered in 1989 to overthrow the communist leader Nicolae Ceausescu. It's the square that tells 100 years of history of Bucharest. But even this place might not escape mutilation in the form of an underground parking place and a mall. Catalina Radulescu is a lawyer working for the Center for Legal Resources.
What's about this rumor? Is it a rumor?
No, it's not a rumor. It's a project of the City Hall.
When is it due to start?
Nobody knows. We asked the documentation, but we never received it, so we don't really know when it's going to start it and why and anything. They are proceeding exactly like the authorities in the communist period. They are forbidding any public participation to their projects. They deny the right of civil society to ask information and to express themselves.
As Cathedral Plaza is reaching to the skies, Roman Catholic believers in St. Joseph's can only pray, but it sounds like it's a tough job to make themselves heard.
Capitalism's a messy business, but seems to lend itself well to confident leadership. And gurus, as everyone in the corporate world knows, are the way to inspire your employees to communicate better, be more open and happy, and therefore more productive. The giant Dutch bank ABN AMRO has picked up on this idea and has tried to get its 20,000 employees to think more positively about work. They hired an American mantra-spewing guru, but with a difference. He was an actor, and most of what he said on his month-long tour of the company was improvised or made up, albeit with some wisdom mixed in. Almost no one was in on the act. So what was it all for? The Dutch media has now picked up on the story, and some are wondering what one of the world's largest banks is up to. Daniel Frankel is the actor in question's real name, and he told me he was impressed that the bank was thinking outside the box.
Large banks are generally conservative organizations, and for... First off, a conservative organization like this to understand that they have a dynamic of a problem that they want to work on, open communication, and then to employ a very different out-of-the-box kind of solution like bringing in a fake guru, that was special. That was cool. And the idea that it wasn't controllable. You can't predict how 20,000 people are going to react to something like this. So in some ways they were taking quite a risk.
This is a really revolutionary idea, though, isn't it? Taking an actor, getting him to pretend to be a guru who ostensibly is supposed to inspire the people he's talking to, and then at the end of the scheme, letting everybody know that they've been duped. Did that make you nervous?
No, but then I would say that I'm not simply an actor. It wasn't acting in such as having a script. It was improvisational. So I had to come and I had to talk about open communication. And I could weave... truth and untruth together. I wasn't so fettered by having to support everything I was saying with statistics. And a very strong element of this was this idea of celebrity, because understand that the bank, before I ever set foot in the door, built a kind of celebrity through lots of larger than life-size posters, desk clocks.
Of you.
Of me, all with rather nauseatingly. My picture was way overexposed in the company. And it led to, yeah, a combination. There's a lot of different levels on how this worked. It didn't work in one simple way. It worked in many different ways at the same time. So some people were immediately overexposed and sick of, you know, who is this American guru who's coming over to speak to us? Other people were infatuated by the celebrity aspect that was created. I think what I was exploiting was people's media concepts of the guru and the manager. And these concepts are built from Michael Douglas in Wall Street back in the late 80s. And Tony Robbins, the motivational speaker who's been very big for many years back in the States. And Donald Trump now in The Apprentice.
Leadership is very important in business. You have to inspire your staff. You have to really make them respect you. Go ahead, do it. You never quit. I make life interesting.
Greed is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Thank you very much.
That's how do you take the invisible and make it visible, right? How do you take what you dream about and make it happen? You know the rules, you write the code, you follow those, and you get the result. Once you know the game, you just, you know, you up the ante, don't you?
A seven-year-old might very well ask at the end of this whole idea, this whole scheme that you've just been at the centre of, if this is designed to increase openness and direct communication in the workplace, how can you use deception to bring that about?
I can't necessarily explain it or justify it. I presume the argument would be that to create a large organizational change, you've got to shake the organization. There needs to be a kind of a catalyst. So what I know is that the intentions of internal communication to try to make this organization more open, I find those intentions to be very noble, and I think a lot of other organizations probably need to be doing similar things. In order to create that energy, that was the justification for using a false character. Almost one-fourth to one-third of the organization had some kind of, there was a website where they could click on a button to vote if they had confidence in what I was doing or not. And we had, my understanding was we had one-fourth to one-third of the organization had responded to this character. We're talking about 6,000-7,000 people. Negatively or positively, but the idea was they were engaged. And by any measurement, that was considered to be phenomenal. And that all happened within a matter of a few days. So the idea that they piqued the energy of this organization and had everybody looking at this idea of open communication, now that's something.
Actor and would-be guru Daniel Frankel there. Staying with the business theme here on Network Guru, one seemingly effective way to promote your company's interests is to hire a professional to do your bidding for you. These campaigners are known as lobbyists, and they don't come cheap. But critics of the profession say it's undemocratic and lacks transparency, which is why the European Commission's now trying to regulate the industry. Deutsche Welle's Johannes Barker takes us up the corridors of power.
The aim of the lobbyists is to contact the representatives wherever they can. Business lunches, parliamentary committees and conferences are all perfect opportunities to get in touch with political decision makers. But while lobbying may be considered a useful political tool, its practices and the lack of transparency can also be a problem. Gérard Honestat, Vice President of the European Parliament.
There is no doubt a lack of transparency. Usually lobbyists have to wear a badge to enter the building, but then in the committee meetings, which are public, they come and talk to you and you don't really know for sure where they're coming from. They may tell you that they're working for a legitimate organization, but in the end, the motives are maybe a bit questionable. There could definitely be room for improvement.
And that's exactly what CM Kallas, the Commissioner for Administrative Affairs, has in mind. When it comes to transparency, Kallas wants to introduce a code of conduct for lobbyists. They will have to register with the European Commission, provide information about their financial sources and the interests they are representing. Eric Roselius from the Corporate Europe Observatory.
We need to know who is paying certain lobby firms. Who are their clients? Often they don't want to tell. They don't want to tell, and that's really, really a problem.
Close to 70% of lobbyists in Brussels defend the interests of large multinational corporations and major industries. And their financial means are huge. According to the Corporate Europe Observatory, up to 1 billion euro a year is spent on lobbying activities in Brussels. So, when it comes to transparency, lobbyists are ready to concur, but under certain conditions. The lobbyist, Stéphane de Sella.
I have no problem with saying whom I'm working for as long as professional secrets are kept and confidentiality is respected. We have to find the right balance between saying for whom we're working and violating commercial secrets. If we disclose, for example, the budgets we have for each client, there's a big chance we'll lose those clients to other consultancies. So the Commission also has to be sensitive to this issue.
But to avoid Brussels lobbyists taking over the European decision-making process, the Commission has to establish clear rules, not least of all in the interest of European citizens.
Now, from organisations buying political influence, we move to selling influence in return for letting someone set up a military base in your backyard. That someone is, of course, the US, and the proposed new military bases would be in Poland and the Czech Republic. The plans have prompted lively debate there and have angered Russia considerably. Radio Prague's Rob Cameron has more.
Lunchtime at Rozhmital's Pansky Dum pub, and the workers are filling up on plates of goulash and pints of beer. Rozhmital is a few minutes' drive from the rolling Brdy Hills, which America's Missile Defense Agency has chosen as a potential site for a radar station. At the height of the Cold War, the Brdy Hills were bristling with Russian missiles. The Russians have long gone, of course, but the area remains a restricted military zone. And if the US radar station becomes reality, it would be the first line of defense against an incoming missile attack. And it seems that's not something the people of Rozhmital are very happy about.
When the Russians had their missiles here, we had to keep our mouths shut. Now the Americans want to put their radar here. But the difference is we've got the right to speak out. And I'll tell you this, I'm against it. It would be like the bad old days all over again. I think it would make this place a military target, and a terrorist target too. I can't see the point of it, not only because it would be a military target, but also because it wouldn't offer anything to the local people. It would need to offer something to the community, like jobs.
Here in Prague, the campaign against the radar base is gathering momentum. The city library recently hosted a public meeting by a civic initiative called No to Bases, with speeches from some of Europe's leading peace activists. Jan Tamás is the initiative's spokesman.
We believe this is a step in the wrong direction. We believe that if we want to live in peace, if we want to live in a secure Europe and in a secure world, we need to begin disarming, not building new weapons, not building new military equipment, and not establishing new military bases.
Executive Office.
Across town at the heavily guarded U.S. Embassy, Ambassador Richard Graeber's task is to explain the benefits of missile defense. His fundamental message is that a radar base poses no threat to either human health or the environment. And most of all, he says, it will not turn the Czech Republic into a prime military target.
We're talking about the safety and security of not only the Czech Republic, but Europe and the United States. It's a difficult world right now. We face threats and potential threats from countries such as Iran and North Korea. And the United States believes that it's very, very important to proceed with this facility.
And that's despite a great deal of saber-rattling from Moscow since the Czechs and Poles said yes, in theory, to missile defense. The head of Russia's missile command sent shivers down many a spine when he said his country would realign its rockets to target Poland and the Czech Republic, if they went ahead. But that threat has been brushed aside by Czech officials. Alexander Vondra is the country's deputy prime minister.
We have two options, either to leave them alone, to build this on, let's say, the national level, but it would lead to the decoupling and it would weaken NATO substantially, or to do this together with them. And I think this system, which we plan to develop together with the U.S., should be in future a certain backbone of the NATO system once the NATO has agreed unanimously to do this.
Local people are largely against the base and are expected to say so in a series of non-binding referendums. Public opinion, meanwhile, is also turning against the idea. But even if the Czech public were in favour, the base is not a done deal. Far from it. The plan must be approved by Parliament, where the government has no majority. Czech officials may have given a cautious thumbs up to the American missile defence plan. But here in Prague, it seems the battle for the radar base is just beginning.
Rob Cameron from Radio Prague with that report. And that's all from Network Europe for this week. Network Europe is a collaboration of Europe's leading broadcasters, Radio Netherlands, Radio Sweden, Radio Slovenia, Radio Slovakia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Prague, Radio Bulgaria, Radio France International and Polish Radio External Services. Network Europe will be back next week, coming to you from Warsaw. But for now, from me, Richard Walker, here in Hilversum in Holland, thanks for listening.
Coming on February 11th.